copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
As a group of Christians, and so obviously each individual, it would apply to every individual as well, but as a church, what are the bridges we have towards people so that we've got a landing point in front of them where they're going to say, yeah, we can talk about that. Now, obviously, we're talking about naturalism and so on. Not everyone is going to be a naturalist, but what are the bridges we have? I think the principle is, when we were talking in Acts, was I have become all things to all men so that by all possible means I might save some. So this is the adaptation side. This is the bridges we're looking for, because if you remember in the context, he says, I became like a Jew with those who are Jews, like a Gentile with those who are Gentiles, those without law who don't have law, and so on. So he's trying to find another expression you could use instead of building bridges, are points of contact with people. And I'm not going to go through what we've already seen, but I thought it was good to start by just reminding us of these three very different situations in just part of the book of Acts, where Paul is definitely speaking from the scriptures in the synagogue in Pisidian Antioch and identifying himself as a Jew, whereas when he's talking to the peasants in Lystra, he talks about God the Creator, who gave the sun and the rain and therefore food, and therefore they can be happy. Apologetics for the French, if you like, the food and being happy. You say that? And then the third one, Athens, the intellectual capital of the Roman Empire, where if you examine the text, he uses a lot more abstract language. He quotes their own poets and so on, and starting from the altar to the unknown God. Okay, we've seen all that, but they're examples of bridges. But what bridges do we have today? And in my thinking, I have thought of three possible bridges. Four possible bridges, which you find in your notes, and which were the basis of several of the books I've written and the video course I wrote in French. I hope that it won't seem too abstract, because French thought tends to start from abstractness and to move towards the concrete afterwards. An example of that, that we say the genius of the French language, I was once driving by car and I went through the UK and France and saw the same road sign, and they were doing work, so there were no road markings, if you like. And in England it just said no white lights. Three short concrete words. In France it said absence of horizontal signalization. That is fantastic. That is the French way of expressing themselves. I don't know what tourists thought, but we understood what they meant. So, the four bridges are our common humanity, the human condition. The church has the new humanity, spirituality, and the storyline of history. I'd like to present to you for a few minutes why I think these are bridges in today's world. Let's start with the first one. Okay, our human condition. If there's one thing that we have in common, well, possibly two things. Someone once said to me that there's one thing in common between Christians and non-Christians. We all hate evangelism. But that's not the point I'm trying to make. The one thing we have in common with everyone around us is that we are human beings and they are human beings. It might seem absolutely basic to say so, but it's important to say that, so that we know that the people around us are having the same thoughts. I've got to get my kids to school. I've got to drop in and get something at the shop. Will I make ends meet? Where am I going to go on holiday this year? I've got to remember the light bulb's not working in the bathroom. And so we all have these common things, but beyond that, I think that our common humanity is a very important aspect in evangelism. I see three sides to that. The first, you could call our human solidarity. What I think is very interesting, I hope you'll find it interesting, I find it is, that in the postmodern world, the more we and better we are Christians, the more we are doing evangelism indirectly. There's not a difference between the two. That's what I was trying to say on Monday, that evangelism isn't just tacked on at the end. Because for our human solidarity, I'll come back to the verse in a moment, I think it's on another slide, Matthew 22:39. Love your neighbor as yourself. And that is the second commandment. So the more we love people, the more, in a sense, we're going to want to share things with them. But loving people is also in doing very practical things. In some cases, I'm sure there are people here who are dealing with drug addicts or broken families, all sorts of social issues. In the case of our church in Paris, we're not in an area where there are a lot of social issues. People are okay on the whole. But my wife and I are very interested in the development of the countries in the, what people call the third world. And so we opened a fair trade shop in the street next to the church called Equitio. That's because fair trade in French is commerce équitable, and théo, Christians realize there's an H in it, but we also have Christian books. But in fact, in French at the moment, a lot of companies like the ending EO. It's very much sort of in the kind of names that people have today. So Equitio. I'll show you a couple of pictures of our shop. That's the outside. Okay. I was looking at the screen there, I wasn't looking there. You can't really see that at all. I'll go on to the next one. Okay, you can see a little bit through the shop. It's brilliantly done. We had a Christian interior architect to do it for us. So we have all sorts of things. We have food, from fair trade, handmade articles and books. And here we have a corner with some seats and a little table, and we can drink coffee, fair trade coffee, and so on. And that's fine. What is interesting with that is that we think that we are doing something useful for the developing countries. Yet, at the same time, this is about the only way we could think of in Paris of having contact with people living in the area. Because they all live in their flats with a code to get into the building, a second code to make the lift work, and a third code to get into their flat. You just can't do it. So at least people are coming to us, and we are making contact with people in that way. But I think as people see that we're not just sort of talking about spiritual things, we're also doing something to help people, that this is an element of evangelism which I don't think has been mentioned as such until now, which is promoting the gospel. There's a very interesting book written by an Austrian, I can't remember his name, called Promoting the Gospel, in which he's saying that gospeling is talking, it's speaking, but people are also looking at what we're doing. So if they think, yeah, this church is doing something good, then we'll listen to what they're saying, because we've been convinced of the good they're doing. And we want to take this further. I have a daughter who is a midwife, a missionary in Madagascar, and we want to create a whole project for them to buy some equipment for the hospital. And we reckon the best way of doing it is to try to get non-Christians around the church involved in this, in the fundraising, because they want to do this as well. It's part of what they want to do. And then we'll get to know them, and this will give us bridges towards them as well. So what I'm trying to say is, everything we are doing, which is biblical, is also a bridge towards the people. So the first bridge is our human solidarity, Matthew 22:39. The second is just our human identity. Who are we? Because I think in Europe today, that question of our identity is being always asked. Who am I? What am I? And when we start the gospel with, you have value because you are made in the image of God, that human identity is very important for people. And I think that what was interesting, I don't know if anyone has read the book Basic Christianity by John Stott. I became a Christian through reading Basic Christianity by John Stott. And he was interviewed at the end of his life, and they said, if you would write again, what changes would you make? And he said, I'd add a chapter at the beginning to say that human beings have real value because they're made in the image of God. And that was a very perceptive thing to say. And that was John Stott's analysis of his own book. So, our common humanity, we're also saying, yeah, we're doing this because we have value. Everyone has value. We're made in the image of God. And the third aspect of this human condition is our human experience of conversion. And I could read Romans 8:29. A very small print Bible. Okay, those whom God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the likeness of his Son. So what I say is that when we become a Christian, three things happen at least. The first is the restoration of our relationship with God. That's the reconciliation with God. The first we're talking as ambassadors, you know, be reconciled with God. The second is the restoration of the image of God in us, which isn't lost in non-Christians, but needs to be restored. And the third is the restoration of our relationships. So in other words, as I often put it, when someone becomes a Christian, they start becoming more human. So Christians are the most human of all humans. And that's what we want people to see. I want people to see my church, push the door open, come in and say, wow, I've been looking for that sort of thing all my life. I'm going to talk more about that in a moment with the church as the new humanity. But in which there is restoration of relationships, and we are really human. And sometimes in our churches, we are not so human because we're being too spiritual. I thought of this the other day. I went to see a film that's just come out in France called Qu'est-ce qu'on a fait au bon Dieu? If you saw that, whatever do we do to God? It's about a very bourgeois Catholic family who, and their four daughters get married to a Jew, an Arab, a Chinese guy, and then an African. And the first three didn't like the African at first. But anyway, but what was interesting was that they wanted to show that they were really, really part of the family. So they all decided they were going to midnight mass at Christmas. And so they went to this little village Catholic Church to sing Midnight Mass, and it was, the song "Il est né le divin enfant." A lot of people know that song, and all the people sort of sing "Il est né le," and these Arabs and black and Chinese were all singing and sort of smiling and looking around at each other and sort of, "This is great," you know? And everyone said, "What are they doing, smiling, you know, singing this?" I thought it was very interesting. But I remember once going to a church with my wife, and it was in the days before PowerPoints. It must have been about 15 years ago. And we went to this church, and no one greeted us. And everyone was singing, like really with their songbooks. In those days, there were songbooks. And no one, even the people each side of us, never thought to even say, "Have a songbook." And they, well, how is it possible that we're not human, if you like, in the relationship we had with people? People just want to be welcomed. And so, if we're not human, in a sense, we haven't been properly converted. Because the Christian, repeat, is the most human of all humans. So the first bridge we have, I think, is just our human condition, being human, showing solidarity. That doesn't mean you have to open a fair trade shop or even create some kind of association. It may be just helping the people in your block of flats or a neighbor or whatever, just showing an interest in someone. I think that's, I'm going to come back to that as well. So the first bridge, our human condition. Any comments or questions about that first one?
There's a wonderful quotation I read the other day, just picking up from a book. It said, Jesus did not come primarily to make you Christian, but to make you human.
I think it is. I remember a guy the word wasn't used in those days, the discipling. He came from a very difficult background. And I used to say to him, my aim is not to make you a better Christian, just to make you a better man. You know, get a job, hold down a job, you know, just, that's... Okay, he was already a Christian, you could be very spiritually minded about sanctification, but if he couldn't keep a job, then...
Like you were saying about what you're saying about people can, Christians can become too spiritual, concentrate on perhaps allowing their life without using words. Was it Francis Assisi who said, when he got to the island, let's use words if we have to?
I think you can push that too far. I think that we, I can't remember who said it. I think it was the Cape Town, Lausanne conference. Someone said something like, "Let's eat food if necessary." Like Craig's going to note that down. He's going to say it in a training session next week.
I can't wait to throw it to St. Francis when I get there. Of course, we didn't
work. I just had a question along the same lines, kind of on the third point, the restoration of our relationships. It relates a bit to the survey you showed us in your first talk. What pastors most wanted was training on how to help people have relationships. And that's something I see hugely lacking in Christian students that I work with. They don't understand how to relate to people who aren't Christians, so they kind of hold back. There is something about the fact that we are more fully human than Christians.
Yeah.
And so how has this become such a defining part of being a kind of Christian culture? Is this
I think there are probably two aspects to that. I'm not sure it's only Christians, because there is a trend with all the social media to keep your relationships at a distance, and to actually talk to someone is not always so easy. But for Christians, I think there's the real fear that if people know what I am, they're going to reject me, whereas other people don't have that problem. Or put it in another way. This is a kind of one of these little moments that I was walking down the street once in Paris, and I walked past a cafe, and there were people talking, And I only heard three words. And this really struck me. The guy said, à mon avis, which means in my opinion. Now, if you're talking around a table and each person is saying, in my opinion, that's okay. But we're not. We're saying, in God's opinion, or what the Bible says. So we're not quite on the same playing field. And I think that is part of the problem. How do we deal with that? How do we say what we believe and not just sound subjective? But as soon as you start being objective, people are saying you're trying to force something down me. It's not just your opinion. I think there are a lot of big questions. And I was at the meeting about Ukraine last night, and this came out a lot. The question, what is our identity? We hadn't thought it out. How do we communicate our identity? How far do we go? And so on. And I don't think it's quite the same debate as saying as the debate we had just now. It's not, you know, do you want to bring some to the law straight away or not? I think it's much more a debate on how do we say these things and not, in today's world, just sort of cut off the communication. Because if I wanted to react to what brother said just now, he was reacting a little bit to the idea, which is probably always said in the USA, you know, you must make for closure. I don't think many Christians I know in France think that you're going to make for closure the first time you meet somebody. Our problem is more opening your mouth at all, I think. So I think that is why we have to learn, and why the pastors are saying it, I think, in the survey. And I think I'm a pastor. I'm not sure that I would know all the answers to that, but I think we need to learn. Okay, I'll go on to the second bridge. The second bridge is the new humanity, which from in Ephesians, the great chapter, which talks about salvation, you know, verse 8 and 9, says through faith by grace. Moving to verse 10, we have God's workmanship, the word poiemai, poiema or other, meaning workmanship. We get the word poem from it, you know. I often say that, is this word used in English? Chef d'oeuvre, meaning the best you can possibly be. No, it's not an English word. The greatest thing in God's creation, I sometimes say to people, this is God's workmanship. Don't go and look at the Atlantic coast. Don't go and look at the Alps. Go to a Christian meeting and look at each other. That is the greatest thing in God's workmanship, just seeing other brothers and sisters. And the way this spells comes out, in fact, in this new humanity, is where Paul talks about the wall of separation falling between Jew and Gentile, and he uses the word the new man, but I take man in this sense to be humanity. In fact, in French, modern translations use the word humanity rather than man, because it means all human beings. And in one sense, that's what we're trying to do in the church. People are looking for community and identity. This is why the church is the letter of God. I will come back to that. And so it's the place where all the barriers can fall down between rich and poor, different social classes, male, female, ages, and so on. I know in my church we're trying to think out, you know, how we can be an all-age church. It's not an easy question either. You know, how you involve the children and so on. Anyway, the church is one of the few places where you have people of all ages and conditions together. And so we can find our identity, our common identity, being in Christ and not in the other identities which may exist and which may be valid on their level, such as being male or female, such as being European or African or whatever, or feminist, or wanting independence for Corsica or whatever, which is the Corsicans want, except they still want the money from France, but that's a that's a different point. So the church is where this new humanity is being lived out, and I would go as far as to call it incarnation. I'll give you a few verses. No one has ever seen God, John 1:18. Can anyone complete the sentence?
God, the one and only, has made him known.
Yeah, it's, in other words, Jesus, the Son, has made him known. Okay, so you can find other verses such as John 14:9. He who has seen me has seen the Father, and so on. So Jesus has made God visible. Okay? Because he is God incarnate. Now, no one has ever seen God. It comes back a second time in the New Testament. 1 John 4:12. Much less well known. No one has ever seen God, but if we love each other, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. And if you look, I think, in the context, it's loving each other. It's like John 13, 35. By this shall all men know you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. So the church is also, in a sense, the incarnation of God being visible. And I take this from Scripture as well, 1 Corinthians 12 and other verses, that we are the body of Christ, and the body can be seen. It's a secondary level of incarnation. I'm not saying it's the same as the incarnation of Christ, but it is an incarnation, literally meaning in the flesh. People can see us. People can see us. So in 2 Corinthians 3, verse 2, Paul can write to the Corinthians and say, you yourselves are our letter, written on our hearts and known and read by everybody. So the church is like a letter known and read by everybody. The church is God's tract, God's flyer, God's letter, whatever you want to call it, because this is what people see. And the interesting thing is that I think I might have mentioned it to some people the other day. I've just been writing a book on atheism, and found that very few people who are considered to be atheists were really atheists. They were usually anti-religion, anti-church, anti-clerical, as we say in France. So in a sense, one of the ways to counter that is argument, but also, well, come and have a look. Be with us. The expression I sometimes use is, walk in our landscape. Come and spend time with us. See what it's like. Welcome people. And so that is certainly true for Christians. Welcome one another, therefore, just as Christ has welcomed you for the glory of God. And so we welcome each other with all our differences. And that is an amazing thing, because we are so different. When you start, you know, the people who are more outgoing or not, people who arrive on time, those who don't, and that sort of thing. Remember once a friend of mine who's a Christian had a young apprentice staying with him for a few weeks, and he led him to the Lord. But he said, well, I've never ever met someone who was more different to me than I was. He said, the worst was yesterday. He saw it, and he said, yesterday, I walked past the bathroom when he was brushing his teeth. And everyone brushes their teeth the same way. I know, he held his brush and moved his head. And so we have to accept the people with the differences, and therefore they will see this new humanity in which our unity is not because we brush our teeth the same way, but in Christ. And this is our number one identity above all the rest. So, as a conclusion of that, firstly we can say it's the importance of relationships. Beyond conviviality, if that word exists in English, does it? Yeah. Beyond conviviality, showing a real interest in people. To say you love others can be a bit vague, but showing a real interest in people is different. I think showing an interest in each other as Christians and also to other people who come, and because the church is embedded in a local culture, it also shows hopefully the plausibility in every cultural context. That was on my PowerPoint, I didn't want to take it off. That was a book I wrote called Serving the French People, Servir à nos Français, which is a quotation from John Calvin, who said that his main aim in writing the Institutes of the Christian Religion was to serve the French people. Don't forget that. To serve the French people, he said. And he continues, I saw many of them hungry and thirsty for God, but in complete ignorance. 500 years later, we still have sometimes the same thing. So we have to embed it into our local culture. Just a few comments about that. We mentioned the other day about new atheism in the English-speaking world not being a problem for us. There's another philosophical current which, as far as I can tell, has never been mentioned once since the beginning of this forum, which I would say personally is the number one philosophy in France today, which is called phenomenology. No one ever talks about it. We haven't got a book in it because the English-speaking world probably don't know what it is, so we can't translate it. Siri is going to write one soon on the subject. No, that's it. do you have phenomenology in your countries?
Phenomenology.
It came from a guy called, I think it was Austrian, Husserl.
Yeah.
Phenomenology. In an English-speaking world, you probably wouldn't, because they're more into analytic philosophy, and which is not. This is more in the continental philosophy, but it's a way of trying to find meaning, because it's beyond postmodernity to say how are we going to find meaning despite the fact there isn't any meaning. And it's a bit complex, and I think some people, I say, interpret it in different ways, but being very simple, I think you could say, but we could discuss this, that you see, for example, that people will love each other and even give their life in love for someone. So you say, well, why do they do it? There's no reason for it, but we observe that they do. Therefore, this little fact means that you have some meaning, even if you can't fit it into a world view or something. You see what I mean? You sort of try to find a way past the fact that there's no meaning. But that's simplifying it a bit. Another question, for example, I'm talking about plausibility in each context, because each church, each country must find the way of communicating in their country. Another French example is this. When Greg was talking last night, I have no problems with point one and point two, but I have a real problem with point three. Why? Because there's no word in French for mind. It doesn't exist. The word does not exist. So that means that since a people thinks in the categories of the words they've got, to talk about the mind is absolutely impossible, because it doesn't exist. There's no word for it. And people like Saussure and so on, as linguists, have talked about that you think in categories according to the vocabulary you've got. So you can't use that argument in France, because there's no word to use to say it. Okay.
So the French have, if they don't have mind,
they have brains.
Brains.
And even the word consciousness is not very easy to explain, because we have the same word for consciousness is the word for conscience, meaning good and bad. So you haven't even got a separate word for conscience and consciousness. You got the brain, or the word spirit. But of course, as soon as you use the word spirit, you're into other problems, because are you talking about a sort of a separate spiritual spirit, or are you talking about the human spirit? And so each country must really think through how you communicate in a way that is understandable in your country. Okay, the Church, the New Humanity. A lot more we could say. Any questions?
This is a book you've written.
That's a book I've written.
On the American Church. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It started out as a book on, it was my fourth book, I think. I wrote a book on A Church for Today, which is the church in postmodern world. Another one called Passerelle Bridges. And the third one was on, then, French culture. But it got a bit mixed up with the emerging church, because the emerging church was talking a lot about culture. So we put the two together, which either makes it a better book or a worse book, according to your opinion. So at the same time, it's an analysis of the emerging church. And my thesis is, more or less, that every church will be an emerging church in about 20 years. But it all depends on what you mean by an emerging church. But there are ways of saying things and words which are close to the word. But it does make the argument we had last night very difficult to say. You have to say it in a very different way. That's what I'm saying. But the idea of the new humanity, I would say this is the Christian secret. They're not going to sort of invite people in and say, come in to see the new humanity meeting this Sunday morning at 10:30. You know, we're not going to bill it in that way. But this is what we are, and I think that's what we need to know that we are, so that we're not just thinking, you know, yeah, we meet together for an hour and then we go home, and you know, we are a community, and we have to work on living out as a community. I can't remember if I said that, because I recorded this yesterday, and I can't remember what I said yesterday or or today. But in our church, we try to eat together as a meal two or three times a month after the Sunday service. So it really gives us the chance to get to know each other. It's probably more necessary in Paris, because it's so much more difficult during the week to get together. But it is a way of just saying, we're not just meeting together for a time of worship or whatever. We are a community. Yeah, another thing which makes it quite interesting, because this is where you have to know your own culture. Because Greg was saying just now, ask questions to be friendly. But asking someone a question in France is very impolite. You don't ask direct questions. You would hardly ask someone what their name was. You don't ask questions. You wait for the other person. You sort of negotiate in the discussion to sort of, it, maybe the other person will say, or you will say what your name is, and then if the other person wants to, then he will. But you hardly ever would ask a direct question, like, you know, how many children have you got, or something like that. Even if you're interested, you don't do it. It's not part of culture. And I can remember many years ago, my son was probably only about 10 years old at the time, and we went camping in France with my sister-in-law and husband, and we were putting up our tents. And my son came to me and said, Gerald, my brother-in-law, he's talking to someone, but he doesn't know him. and that sort of showed the French mentality, that you can't just walk up to someone and talk to them. You don't do it. You stand by the bus stop, and no one will say anything. You don't. It's not acceptable to do that. So you have to find other ways of being convivial. Okay. Spirituality. Again, this is a bridge, because there is a certain search for spirituality, transcendence, whatever you want. One leading French atheist, André Comte-Sponville, has written a book on being a spiritual atheist, how to be a spiritual atheist. It's incredible. I wouldn't have thought that a few years ago. But he says, this is wonderful, all this spirituality of these different religions and so on. And it's quite well known that people want spirituality. They go and spend a weekend at a monastery or something like that. It's not the same as religion, but there is an interest in spirituality. And I think this is a bridge, except we have to remember that a lot of postmodern spirituality is not the same as Christian spirituality. And I think we need to see the difference. In postmodern spirituality, the main aim is your well-being. And I remember preaching once in my church, shot one or two people, and I said, if you really want peace, well-being, maybe you should go and see the Buddhists. But if you want a relationship with God and eternal life, you stay with us. it's not quite the same. So it's well-being. It's also immediate and, not in, change that, and individual. Immediate and individual. I was very surprised how postmodern spirituality is individualist. It's not done in groups, generally. It's each one for themselves. And you want it straight away, no long period of discipline or anything. It's syncretistic, mystical. If you go to an esoteric bookshop, the range is immense. And it's contradictory. You can't both say the aim is to find the Holy Grail or to be in the book of the Tibetan Book of the Dead or something. It's not the same thing. It's all there on offer because you validate it. I haven't got this on the thing. You validate the truth by what you feel. That is very, very postmodern. What you feel, validate by feeling. I remember being in Geneva and going to the Museum of the Reformation, and they had a whole lot of cartoons on the way out, and I thought one of them was beautiful. There's a group of people sitting around a table in 16th century Geneva, clothed like they were in the 16th century, and one of them was saying, "This, what Calvin's saying, I can't really feel it." And I thought that was wonderful because that is sort of taking a 21st century term and putting it where it had no place at all. I don't think anyone opposing Calvin would have said at the time, "I can't feel what he's saying." It's a wonderful cartoon. And postmodern spirituality in general only concerns this life. Not very much talk of eternity, possibly Western form of reincarnation, you hang on to a straw somewhere, but most of it is this life center. Whereas, I don't need to tell you, biblical spirituality is both based on salvation at the center, is relational, both relational with God, relations with other Christians and relations with others, and also there's no sacred secular divide. We're Christians, to quote the name of a shop I saw in Uruguay, which is open all day, we're Christians 25 hours a day. That's the name of the shop, open 25 hours a day. I like that. So we have a different spirituality, but I think there is a bridge towards people. And I was very struck by a definition that was given in a meeting in France once, by a guy giving a new definition of evangelism, which was initiation into Christian spirituality. You like it or you don't, but there is a sense in which you're saying, help me to know what Christian spirituality is. And to give an example of how that played out, I once did a series of evangelistic evenings in my church on prayer, inviting non-Christians to come and learn what it is to pray. But of course, as soon as you start, you say, well, when you pray, don't you feel that God is distant? Don't you feel there's a barrier between you and God? So even initiation into Christian spirituality brings you immediately back to the gospel. Okay, if you like that definition, keep it for yourself, but it's a way of building a bridge towards unbelievers to say this is Christianity is also a way into spirituality is also a way into the gospel. Okay, I'd like feedback from you each time because it's more interesting to have the feedback from each point. What is your reaction to that third point, that spirituality is a bridge towards people in Europe today?
Yeah, I think
People are looking for something, I think. They're looking for something transcendent. The fear is religion. Organized religion is the expression that people use. They ought to say organized spirituality for some spiritualities, but they don't. But there is a sense in which there is a need, a hole which needs to be filled. And I think each one of this throws it back to us as to how we live our spirituality in a way which is in tune with our culture. I recently have been doing a lot of thinking and asked musicians about this. What kind of music should we use at a worship service so that people feel that this is the kind of music you should be having if you're worshiping God? What would a French unbeliever think? And we're reaching a few conclusions, one of them being that you need to use the minor key a lot, because French religious music has always used the minor key. So you're not quite so joyful as, or bouncy as some people are. But and what struck me was that when in France we had a lot of demonstrations against same-sex marriage, there was a movement that grew up called the Watchers, Les Veilleurs, which is probably quite a lot of Catholics, but not only Catholics. It wasn't a religious movement as such, who just sat down in front of public buildings with a candle and just stayed there. No one knew what to do with this because it wasn't a demonstration, so they had all these people sitting with candles with all the riot police sort of standing around. But I analysed the songs they sang, and they were nearly all in the minor key, a certain type of music. So if we then import English based music, we're no longer in French spirituality. Few songs, okay, there are a few which are okay, but most of them do not connect, I think, with French unbelievers. It's not what they expect when they come to a church. And surprisingly, I've always noticed this, that when in our church I say, who would like to choose a song? 95% of the time, they choose a song composed in France, and not a song composed from outside. So, another thought on spirituality: how do we live it out in our church life? What do people expect? Surprisingly, one aspect in France is that people like open prayer. It's a specificity of French culture, from brethren through to charismatics through everything. They have a church service. There will always be a moment where you have free prayer. And sometimes in the most amazing places, like you have a congress of 1,000 people, and the person on the stage will say, would 2 or 3 people like to pray? You can't hear what they're saying. But the open prayer is part of it. And what is surprising is that very often a non-Christian will come into your service and pray out loud, because this is somehow in phase, in tune with our culture. I don't know why it is, but they do. They see other people praying, well, so can I. I can pray. So I think each country has to think how this works out, this spirituality, in their context.
One thing that I've been thinking about just a little bit, I was reading this book by Ed Stetzer, and you may have read it, called Planting New Churches in a Postmodern Age.
Planting new churches
in a postmodern age.
Okay.
And he kind of notes some characteristics of churches that have generally worked, however you want to define that. And one of them was experiential worship or experiential spirituality. And I thought, and I may be wrong on this, but just thinking about my life, kind of coming out of kind of 50 years ago or 40 years ago where any signs of spirituality showed that you were really stupid and probably ignorant, you know, you still feel you have to say grace before dinner and that person probably doesn't know anything. Now those little signs I think are being respected. Oh, he's got a spirituality, isn't that nice? Yeah. And I wonder actually whether those, I started doing those types of things more, not because I'm particularly convinced that one has to, but because those things are noticed by unbelievers and they're looking for those aspects of spirituality.
Yeah. It's what I said earlier. What I think is great in a postmodern age, I'm not critical of, obviously, of some things, but the more we are Christian, the better we are at communicating, in a sense, with what we are. And I think very often we're sort of, I had no problem. I marched through Paris 3 times against same-sex marriage. I have my banner and, and everything else. Just had to remember not to bring the Paris Saint-Germain one, but the other one. but in one sense, the best thing we can do in society is to be as Christian as possible and not worry about that, and to be Christians we can in our churches. And I think what that is what you're saying, in a sense, not bother about, you know, what do people think if I pray before meal or something. People always respected it.
Yeah.
In the same way, I don't know if this happens in other countries, at the beginning of the year, you always say to people in French, you know, bonne année, have a good year. And nearly everyone then says, bonne santé, and good health. And I nearly always say, have a good year, and may God bless you. And no one has ever said to me, well, that's a silly thing to say. Because I'm just being what I am. So it goes a bit in that. I've got 10 minutes, so I'm afraid I have to go on. Right, the storyline of history. Well, you know this storyline. Creation, fall, redemption, already but not yet, eternity. What some people might call the meta-narrative, I'll come back to that in a moment. I think it's so important to communicate this. And this is where, in one sense, the debate, do we talk about the simple gospel or not, finds its answer. Because there is no simple gospel unless you understand that God exists. There's no simple gospel unless you know there's a fall, and the world is not what it is. I wrote a book on Blaise Pascal, and he's a fantastic guy. And one of his sentences was this, that the philosophers are like cults, because they won't believe in the fall. So they can't bring any answer because they're not looking at reality. Christians are the only people who can look at reality saying, God has made it, it's good, but it's not what it used to be. So no philosophy has any answer. And that was Pascal in the 16th century. It's fantastic. So you have to know the storyline. I got an artist to paint this this picture. It's 3 meters long, and it goes through creation and the fall. There's a cross there, there's the Holy Spirit giving new life, and this is eternity. In eternity, there's the square representing the New Jerusalem, and all the different colours of the precious stones in the New Jerusalem. I made a postcard of it. I give it to lots of different people as an explanation on the back, and anyone coming into the church sees this and say, what's that? You just explain the story of from creation to eternity. Just quickly, because I think it's important to say, why do postmoderns not believe there is a storyline to history? These three symbols show the three different ways you can imagine history, one being circular. A lot of cultures think the history is circular. Christians always said that it goes from one end to another. But in today's world, it goes in all different directions, no real meaning at all. But, okay, so this is Jean-François Lyotard. Simplifying to the extreme, I define postmodern as incredulity towards meta-narratives. You don't believe there's an explanation, an ideology, any explanation of life. But when we try to say there is one, Why do it? and I give you a few answers afterwards, but partly through there's so much ignorance about it, people don't know it at all, and partly because you might say, well, why do it? Because it's a shocking claim. It's a shocking claim. You're saying there's a true explanation of the human condition, and it divides the world into two, those who believe and those who don't. And in today's world where everyone has to be, to live together, it's seen like something divisive, which we don't want. But I think there are some reasons to say it, and we have a proverb in French that says, when you drive out what is natural, it comes galloping back. And there is a meta-narrative, so I would say the reason why we give the Christian one is, firstly, because no one knows it. They rejected meta-narratives because they're not the real one. And secondly, because it's almost impossible to have any kind of discussion on anything unless you've got that. I mean, the obvious example is same-sex marriage. Why? You have to go back to creation, the fall, and everything else. Otherwise, it's just, I think that, you think that. There's no answer. So, we present the biblical view of history. We counter the idea, it's my choice. That was the name of a TV program in France for a long time. It's my choice. In other words, someone might say, okay, on a Sunday morning, I like to ride my, go on my bike. My wife likes shopping at the market. My son sleeps in. And what you like is obviously singing praise songs. Okay, that's fine. No problem. No problem. But we're not into that. It's not what I like. We're moving into a history, into a story that is greater than us. It also, in one sense, diffuses accusations of proselytism, the attempt to make converts, because we're not saying we want people to come to our church. We're saying we want people to come back to the real storyline of history. I put the storyline of history in French. It's a fantastic, we say, le sens de l'histoire, which has two meanings, the direction of history and the meaning of history. It's the same word for both. So we can bring people back into the meaning through the direction, getting back into the direction of history. It's also a call to repentance, to change your mind about things, to say, yeah, now I see things in a different way. So you call people to repentance and faith, and it also keeps the cross in the center. Okay. Just to conclude, I'll come back. Oh no, that was something I didn't have on my notes. I think we need to find tools to communicate this storyline. One tool is this one, Passerelle, Verdieu. It's the DVD, which is based on this storyline for six weeks. Another thing that I did in France was to pioneer this Bible exhibition. There are 21 reproductions of famous paintings. It takes us through from Genesis right through to Revelation. And so we say this is an art exhibition on the Bible. What we don't tell people is that they're going to go through the story from Genesis to Revelation and understand what it's all about. And as you can see, maybe you can see, it's not very easy on the screen there. There's hardly any words. People listen on a sort of what we call an audio guide. I don't know what you call it. Is that an audio guide? And what is good for that is that we can program it so a whole family can come, because they can either listen to the commentary for adults, for teens, or for children. So the same audio guide can be programmed for three different groups of people, and they can all visit the exhibition at the same time. So there are just two methods of showing the storyline. So to come back to what I said on the very first morning, the conclusions on evangelism is that it is a process, and one way in which it's a process is that people will spend time with Christians will spend time with them, and hopefully, I think, try to bring them to see what's happening in the church. I think people want to see a group of people living this out. I really do. But it's within the context of a relationship, and the church needs to be visible in the public arena. And I'll finish with this quotation, which I really like, from Revelation 3:8. He's talking about an open door, which in the New Testament always means for evangelism. He says, I know your deeds. Behold, I've put before you an open door which no one can shut because you have little power. You'd think it was the opposite. It's because you have little power. And have kept my word, have not denied my name. So that brings me back to what I was saying. I think the more Christian we are, keeping the word, not denying his name, not having little power, we haven't got a lot of access to media and so on, but there is an open door, and we can pray that the Lord will put us in contact with people who are seeking, or the Lord's pushing to us, and to welcome them and bring them into the church so that they can see what our community is, as long as, and the big if is, then our churches must be enough emerged from old way of thinking it's just meetings, so that people really feel that this is a real community of people. I think you have about 1 minute for questions.
You mentioned that there is a certain fear in France of the word organized religion. So, you know, even going to a church building probably is a little bit of a charge, you know, challenge for a lot of the people. How much do you experiment with other forms of, communal life? Meetings in cafes, eating in parks, things that happen outside of the church as a means of Christian community life.
Yeah. Meeting in parks, no, it's too cold in winter. not always through the year. When people say this, it's because I think they very often have in mind the cathedrals and so on. And most evangelical churches are not like that. They're just very simple rooms that people can come to. So they're a little bit surprised at first. But, okay. On the other hand, I think I know with the student movement and that I'm in, meeting for Bible studies in cafes and Starbucks and so on is a good option, because people are on their ground, and that's not a problem for me at all. Okay, time is up. So, thank you very much.